fame, success, you know, the girls, and then you get to the NBA, you have money. I mean, I really had it all. What else could a young kid want?
In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus continues to take what we thought we knew about happiness and turn it upside down. The second beatitude goes like this: blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are those who mourn. Isn't that like another way of saying happy are the sad? It just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. Because from our perspective, happiness comes from our dreams coming true. We think we'll be happy when life is good and we get everything we want. If the Beatitudes were being written to describe how we feel about blessings from a cultural perspective, they would go something like this: blessed are you when everything goes your way. Or maybe, blessed are you when all of your dreams come true.
Grew up in Long Beach, California. My parents separated when I was 7 years old. In terms of church, my mom was the one who took me. What I took in terms of faith and ran with was, nobody's perfect. I'm going to live how I want. I'm gonna try, quote unquote, as hard as I can, and it wasn't very hard. Ultimately, if I mess up, you know, nobody's perfect. God's got me. And it kind of allowed me to have comfort in the afterlife and God and heaven and everything, but also my own life and my own will. What more could you want? I have God and I have me. That was my gospel. I pretty much took that all the way until the beginning of my NBA career. My dad actually played basketball growing up. He introduced me to basketball when I was about 5 years old. I got in my first league at the YMCA, and it was something that I loved. It was something I was pretty good at. Ultimately, basketball was where my passion was. It was what I was the best at. So I stopped doing everything else outside of it. When I got to high school, I guess I started getting in tune with how good I really was. And it was, one, just a sense of my own ego and pride, but also other people telling you, like, oh, you're pretty good at this game. The more I succeeded in it, the more it became who I was. Everything about my life was basketball, whether I was eating, or the relationships I had. If you're not with that, then you're not with that. You could see yourself to the door. It's just kind of how it was for me. Finally, I was being recruited heavily by a lot of different schools and a lot of big time schools, you know, in my opinion. My senior year, I was the guy for my college team and nationally recognized. It's kind of stereotypical. The higher I was going up in basketball, girls started coming. I took advantage of that. I did. Those were the perks. You're being recognized, you're being praised. I mean, the human approval aspect of it all. It was like a drug for me. It was a high, and I loved it. And I was living not just to succeed in basketball, but for people to like me. I realized that through basketball, I could achieve all this secular dream that I wanted. And at that time, in my young mind, I was feeling invincible. And so I was kind of doing whatever, as long as I was being safe with certain things. And by safe, there's huge quotation marks with that. The fame, the success, you know, the girls, what else could a young kid want?
When we read, blessed are those who mourn, there's a tendency to squint at it just right so that we can dismiss it as poetic language. But the poetry falls apart when you start to give some specifics. So instead of just saying blessed are those who mourn, what if you said blessed is the young widow raising four small children? Blessed is the person who loses a job. Blessed is the recovering alcoholic who has nothing left. Blessed is the woman whose husband leaves her for someone else. Then it just doesn't seem to make much sense. But Jesus promises there's a blessing for us in those moments when life just falls apart. Moments of heartbreak, moments of loss, the moments of deep disappointment, the moments when it feels like you've come to the end of yourself.
The day of the draft, I'm watching TV, and I didn't want to watch with anybody because this is my moment to justify kind of my existence. There's only two rounds of basketball, and if you get drafted in the second round, then, you know, it's kind of hit or miss if you get a contract, so it's not guaranteed. They got through the first round, but that's okay because I knew I wasn't really going to get drafted there anyway. Then we get into the second round, comes up, and so now I kind of have a feeling like that turning in my stomach. I got a text from my old strength coach, and he texted me saying congrats, and I'm like, as I saw that before, and I'm like, what is he talking about? And as I look up, you know, they're calling my name. I ran out of the room, and my dad was there too, and my younger sister. We all kind of met, and we were just like screaming in the room, and I ran around my dad's apartment complex. Like, I was like, this is it. I have made it. Like, this is it. Thank you. Thank you, God. In New York, if you're doing well basketball, you can do anything you want in the town. You'd probably run around naked if you wanted to. It's like that crazy. They're treating you as if you're your own kind of demigod. I had a teammate named Jeremy Lin, and he just kind of took the NBA by storm. Couldn't go to restaurants without being, you know, mugged. We had to go out the back ways through kitchens, and these are like five-star restaurants. And so that point too, I'm like, oh my goodness, it just took a whole nother league. This is better than being drafted. Like, now I'm drafted, established, and doing well. Like, what else could happen to me? I just got a new contract with the Toronto Raptors. Getting that contract was more than a grand slam for me, because I was expecting maybe half of that when I was speaking with my agent. And so when that came across, I mean, he was kind of at a loss for words too, because he's just like, are you gonna take it? I'm like, am I gonna take it? Do ducks quack? At this point, I'm like, man, God's on my side. He's got me, this is it. Like, I'm in favor with the Lord. I just went how basketball went. If I was doing well, my emotions ran really high. If I was doing poorly in basketball, if I had a poor game, I was like in despair. And there's 82 games in a season, so kind of the waves of going through that, it was just brutal. It was like it was never able to fully satisfy. And once you get to that point, it's lonely. Why am I so discouraged? I have everything this world can offer. At that time, I'm dating my girlfriend. We were still at a place just doing our own thing. I've known this girl only a few months. She got pregnant. To me, that was the wind out of my sails, because I was like, that can't happen to me. Like, that invincibility factor was still right in my mind and in my heart. Fast forward a few months after signing that huge contract, I get to my first training camp, and as I'm going up to shoot the ball, out of nowhere, my hand just starts curling, kind of just like this. It curls like that. Every shot is doing the same thing. When I'm trying to catch the ball, my hand is curling right before I catch it. When I'm dribbling, my hand starts to just claw up when I'm dribbling, and I'm like, what is going on right now? I went to the trainers, I'm like, something's going on, something's wrong with my hand. I think you just need to massage it, kind of get it out. And came back the next day, the second part of training camp, and it's happening again. And mind you, there's no tingling, there's no numbness, there's no pain, there's nothing outside of just when I go to shoot. I'm like, well, this is not good, because everything was affected by this. So we go to a doctor in Toronto, and he tells me I think something's going on at your wrist, and the nerve is getting hit as you're shooting the ball or trying to catch or whatever kind of you're clinching, whatever it is. And so at that point, I'm like, okay, that kind of makes sense, but I want to get a second opinion. So I fly to New York to see this other hand specialist, who's, you know, renowned in the NBA. And he's like, no, it's not your wrist, it's your elbow. So every time you're going to shoot, the ulnar nerve, which is your funny bone, is being pulled around that bone. So when you go up, it pulls and it curls it down. And so I'm like, okay, this is it. You know, what do we need to do? Let's do it. So I had the surgery done. I finally get back on the court and we're working out, and I'm noticing it's still doing the same thing. Another few months pass, it's worse. It's just everything about it is just happening all over again. And I try to breathe and relax and be like, okay, just shoot the ball like you know how to shoot the ball. And didn't matter. Didn't matter how slow I went, didn't matter how fast I was going. It was just curling every time. Once I realized that the surgery basically didn't work, you know, I was like, okay, God, enter God, what's going on? Can you help heal me? You know, you got a miracle up there somewhere, so let's get me back on my own path, my own will, and, you know, I'll give you a few prayers that you need, and I'll be on my way. I continue to go through the summer, and I go to the next training camp. It's still going on. I had no way to kind of explain it to people because it was an injury so unheard of, you know, not only in the NBA, but a lot of sports. People, after signing this huge contract, they had expectations of me, and this is mostly kind of the fans, and they're like, you know, we gave you all this money, like, what are you doing? And I just want to turn to everybody and be like, you have no idea what's going on here. It's the hardest thing ever, but I couldn't do that. Human approval was my drug, as well as when basketball's not going well. I mean, so you add those two things together and it's brewing for a storm.
The word that Jesus uses for mourn is the strongest word for mourning in the Greek language. The commentator William Barclay says that mourning that Jesus talks about is not only the sorrow which brings an ache to the heart, but it's the sorrow which brings unrestrainable tears to the eyes. So it's surprising that suffering would make room for us to know joy, that in suffering we could actually come to a deeper understanding of God's presence and His peace, that we could find a blessing. We simply can't know that blessing without weeping and without mourning. There's a blessing that comes when life gets hard. In the Old Testament, there's an example of the blessing that comes in mourning. We find it in the life of Job. Satan was looking forward to seeing Job come to the end of himself and also to the end of his faith, but that's not what happened. When we meet up with Job, he's living the good life. He's rich, he's happily married, everything seems to be going well for him. He has 7 sons, 3 daughters, he has 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 donkeys, not to mention a small army of servants. And life is good, but then life begins to fall apart. He begins to experience some suffering. His dream life comes to an end, and he loses literally everything. A strong wind knocks down his house and kills his children. But that's just the beginning. In the second chapter, Job lost his health, and he was infested with sores literally over every inch of his body. He lost all of his livestock, he lost his wealth, and Satan was betting on the fact that as Job lost everything, he would lose his faith in God as well.
My mind at this time is just kind of going nuts. You weren't just taking away basketball, you were taking me away. It's what I live for, and it was my identity. You might as well just be physically punching me in the face, or you might as well be slashing me across with a knife, because basketball is me. I started thinking, and it hit me. I'm like, why would I put all my hope and trust into something that is gonna end anyway? This is kind of sparking that I need to get back into my faith. I need to see what really is really going on here with God. And so that led and bred a whole just explosion of research and diving into the Bible and getting the context of stories and the biblical history. And it made me go back and really explore my faith and just seeing how flawed I am to the core. At that point, I was still going through the Bible and kind of what it was about and, you know, the book of James. What really struck me was, you know, you believe, you do well. Even the demons believe and shudder. I'm like, what is that all about? Okay. And I'm like, so there must be a difference between just mentally assenting to Christ and who he is and actually following him. I compartmentalized God, and it was him over here, and I got everything over here. And if I need you, you know, I'll call on you. I wanted the comfort of the cross without the conviction. Obviously, it wasn't a proper understanding of kind of biblical grace. I didn't understand that truly following Christ was a turning of sin, a turning of my own will and following him. Now I understand that what I was living by was by cheap grace, not just the saving faith and the grace that's truly there. I go to the next training camp and I'm like, okay, there's gotta be something going on, because I'm still holding tight to my idol. Basketball is still there. Like, I'm starting to realize that God is working in my life, but I'm like, I'm not ready to give this up yet. Like, let's continue and focus on me and what's going on. Because it's still going on, I decide I'm gonna go back to the first doctor that I saw, who told me it was at my wrist. Had the surgery, a couple months of rehab, and still going on. I get to a point where now I'm not even playing. Like, they can't play me. I physically can't do it. You're at the end of the bench, and you're sitting last seat with some of the guys back there who don't play. your pride kind of goes out the window and you start thinking of other people. And it was good for me because my whole life was about me and everything was about me, about basketball. And now this gives me a chance to kind of put myself on the rack and give other people what they need to succeed, whatever it is, you know. Get to my third year with Toronto. At this point, my mind is like, it's in a much better place. I'm just like, okay, well, God, whatever, your will be done.
Even Job's wife says to him, just curse God and die. Because really, what good is God if life doesn't work out the way that you want it to? But it turns out that Job experienced a blessing. He knew God in a way that he'd never known God before. Job said in the middle of all of his loss, he said to God, my ears had heard of you before, but now my eyes have seen you. And here's what we find, that in our suffering, there is a deep void that used to be filled by whatever it is we lost. Could be stuff or a job or a relationship. None of those are bad things, but when those things are gone, it leaves this aching cavity, and God is there to fill it up with himself. So when we suffer, we mourn. When we mourn, we are comforted by God's presence. So blessed are those who mourn.
As I kind of dive into Christianity, you kind of get that kind of urgency to kind of do things the right way. So I'm like, okay, I got to propose, I got to get married, I need to repent of this sin and start living a pure life, married. And so we did that. Our marriage started off very rocky. It was getting to know a girl who, again, I barely knew. When God talks about, like, wait until you're married, I get it now. God's not a dictator just trying to establish some ruling on you because he's on a power trip. It's actually out of love that he's saying, just wait. Get to know the person, you know, allow yourself to be emotionally naked before them before you get physically naked before them. Every marriage still needs work, but it's a more solid foundation right now, and that's because ultimately we came to the point where we need to build this foundation not on our wills or what we're doing, but on Christ. And so out of him is kind of birthing a wonderful marriage, in my opinion. I think she'd say the same. I hope she would. I can give her a call. We'll see. What I was doing with my life was taking basketball, making it ultimate. It's dangerous territory when you're taking these wonderful things, the gifts of God, and making them and putting them above the gift giver. God creating the perfect storm for my idols to weed them out and put himself in. And it was, at times, a very hard process. Ultimately, I realized that you have a good and loving purpose for this because you are good and loving towards us. It's something where the more I've come to know him, the more I've come to trust him, the more I've come to love him, my prayers actually changed in the process. Instead of saying, you know, Lord, bring back my career, heal my hand, you know, get me back to where I want to go. He's saying, I'm not going to do that for you. I'm going to, instead of giving you basketball, I'm going to give you myself. That godly sorrow that I had for my idols is replaced by joy in him. And the joy that I get in him surpasses any kind of mourning that was, you know, in my life from basketball. I have something just so much more grand and beautiful and infinite than this finite game over here. I still love it, absolutely. It's fun to play, but now it's in its proper place in my life where I can look at it and just be satisfied. I have this hope now that is beyond comprehension. I can't sit here and fully explain to you what it is until, you know, you yourself go and experience this. Get to know God, get to know his character. He's revealed himself through his word, what he's done for you through Jesus on the cross. I mean, the ramifications, the implications of that are monumental. And to have a proper understanding of that, it makes your dreams just kind of like whatever. Whatever I'm doing next, I hope it's for an overall good. I hope to magnify Christ. So I'm gonna bring my passion and need together. It's not glorifying me and who I am, but glorifying him. It's crazy to get from where I'm at to that is, I don't even know what to say. To me, it's amazing.
Of course, we do everything we can to avoid suffering. Of course, we want to stay away from any kind of personal difficulty or disappointment. But inevitably, we're going to experience our share of it. When we do experience it, we tend to want to stay away from mourning. And so when we catch ourselves mourning, we do everything in our power to just make it go away. We numb ourselves with entertainment. We medicate the pain away with drinking or shopping or working or partying. We may have to suffer, but nobody's gonna make us mourn. And so we try to shift our efforts to just getting over it. We wanna get past it. We wanna get around it. We wanna just move on from the broken heart of a wrecked relationship or the debilitating regret of a disastrous decision or the impossible options of a serious illness. But living in denial and blaming others or basking in the guilt is no way to live. Instead, when we turn to God, we find there's a blessing in those difficult moments. Eugene Peterson paraphrases this promise in Matthew chapter 5, verse 4 this way. He says, "You're blessed when you feel you've lost what is most dear to you, because only then can you be embraced by the one who is most dear to you." So at the end of yourself, you have an opportunity to experience the presence of God in a way that you never have before.